It's Wednesday, November the 9th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Slightly different format today. We are recording a little bit earlier than usual at 8 a.m. Irish time. Although another way of looking at that is that it's pretty late for our guest, Irish Times Washington correspondent Martin Wall. Hi, Martin.
Hello, Hugh. How are you? It's 3 a.m. in Washington, D.C.
Okay, keep drinking that coffee. Hopefully you're nearly done for the night. But anyway, the results from the United States midterm elections, they've been coming in for the last few hours. We should caveat that they're still far from complete in many crucial contests, and it may take days or even weeks, actually, to get an absolutely final tally. But just to remind listeners that all the seats in the House of Representatives were up for grabs, along with one third of the Senate and a range of important governorships, along with a multiplicity of other down ballot races and state level votes and all kinds of issues ranging from abortion rights to the legalization of marijuana, etc., etc., etc. But it's a very big, it's a sometimes confusing picture. But Martin, it's fair to say, isn't it, that most experts went into this night expecting a good night for Republicans, and it hasn't quite turned out that way.
Virtually every poll and every pundit for the last 2 weeks were forecasting a landslide for Republicans. Now, however, there were a small number of Democratic strategists who were saying, hold on, these polls are wrong. They were making allegations that Republicans were, as they say, flooding the zone with dodgy polls or dodgy poll results with a view to depressing turnout. And they were hoping that there was a, you know, even before we started today, 40 million people had voted as part of the early voting arrangements in many states. And some Democratic strategists were saying this early voting could be good for us. But the general preponderance of media punditry and political punditry in the United States was suggesting that the Republicans were on their way to a landslide. The Republicans a few months ago had been talking about a 60-seat majority in the House of Representatives. And not only had they have a situation whereby all the political winds were going in their favour. The president's popularity is underwater. He's far more unpopular than he is popular. Inflation is running at about 8.5% in the United States, largely the same as it is in Ireland, but most Americans only consider inflation in their own country rather than elsewhere. And the Democrats didn't really get the message across that inflation is essentially a worldwide problem at the moment. So the Republicans were going in with history on their side, because virtually in recent decades, every first term president took a walloping in their first midterm elections. Barack Obama lost 60 seats in the House of Representatives in 2010. Donald Trump lost the House of Representatives in 2018. And in fact, a president hadn't won in those circumstances since George W. Bush after 9/11. So history and the economic winds and the political punditry were all saying that Joe Biden was going to get a walloping this evening. However, it hasn't turned out that way. And the Democrats who were considered to be vulnerable in both House of Representatives seats, in Senate races, in governor's contests, have all clung on. And the red wave, as they called it here, the landslide that was being forecast, just did not materialise. So we're in a scenario now, as of when we're talking now, is that the Republicans are claiming that they're going to take the House of Representatives. However, their majority is going to be quite thin, going to be quite small. The Senate is still up in the air. The Democrats got a huge boost at about 1 a.m. here in about 6 a.m. in Ireland, when their candidate, John Fetterman, won the crucial seat of Pennsylvania. So it now comes down to, for the Senate, it comes down to what happens in Nevada, what happens in Arizona, and Georgia. It's so tight that it's looking that it's going to be a runoff there, because under the rules in Georgia, under the law in Georgia, if neither of the main candidates gets above 50%, then the top two candidates run off again on the 6th of December. So the actual final determination of the US Senate for the next 2 years could be a few weeks away yet.
So, I mean, I'm just looking at some of those numbers, and, you know, some of them are early numbers. That big win in Pennsylvania, Fetterman's win in Pennsylvania, it means that the Republicans have to win two of those three states you mentioned, Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia. And as you say, Georgia could take a while to come through. Early results, really, from the other two. But there's 50% of votes in, and they're very much in play. They're toss-ups with, I think, in both cases, the Democrats marginally ahead. One has to be careful about, you know, which parts of each state have returned results so far.
That is correct. But if the trends are going in the way they seem to be going, and if the Democrats hold on to their seats in their Senate seats in Arizona and Nevada, well, then in the context of who controls the United States Senate, it will not matter what happens in Georgia. So if they would obviously have an extra seat in the bag, because the Democrats, by winning Pennsylvania, they won a seat that had been held up to now by Republicans. It was a net gain. So therefore, if they hold Arizona and Nevada, Georgia doesn't matter. And now there are internal dynamics within the Democratic Party. There was their senator from West Virginia, Joe Manchin, held up a lot of the Biden agenda for several months last year. His vote would become irrelevant at that point if they control the Senate. At that point, so. And again, we still don't know what is going to happen in the House of Representatives. There are projections from American TV going around that it could be as low as one seat of a Republican majority. And that creates its own problems in relation for the Republicans.
Yeah, and we might look at that just in a moment, because I know the putative majority leader of the next House, Kevin McCarthy, the Republican, if they do get their majority, was speaking just in the last hour or so. But just looking at the overall build-up and what you were saying earlier on about the predictions not coming to pass, it seems to me there was a kind of an ebb and flow over the course of the summer and into the autumn, both to some extent in the polls, but maybe even more so in the analysis. And maybe we paid too much attention to the pundits and not enough to the numbers. So you had a situation at the start of the summer where Joe Biden was deep underwater. There was lots of concern about inflation and the economy, and there was still the backwash from things like the fairly catastrophic exit from Afghanistan the year before. And then in the wake of the Roe versus Wade decision in the Supreme Court, there seemed to be a kind of a backlash, and the Democrats were doing much better from August into September. But then again, those economic issues seemed to reassert themselves in the last 6 weeks, 2 months of the campaign. And the expectation was that these suburban voters, suburban women in particular, who were not happy with the Supreme Court decision, were perhaps going back to Republicans because of those economic issues. Maybe that was overstated in the end. It looks like that wave back against a wave against a wave.
Yeah, you set out the history of it there quite well. And it does appear today, from the exit poll data today, would indicate that abortion was a bigger issue than the pundits had thought it was going to be. That they thought initially after last June, when the Roe v. Wade decision was, when Roe v. Wade was overturned and the federal constitutional right to an abortion was eliminated by the Supreme Court, that abortion was going to be a big issue. That seemed to be the case over the summer. There were a number of, as what we call them here, by-elections, where basically Democrats ran essentially as a referendum on abortion and won. But then it seemed to fade away, or certainly the polling data seemed to suggest it faded away. And there was data that the economy was the be-all and end-all of everything, and nobody really cared about anything else. Everything else was trailing behind. And then, lo and behold, the exit poll today, it transpires that the economy and abortion were fairly close together as big issues. So once that happened, and then you saw the turnout in terms of the younger people, the turnout of younger voters and women voters, it seemed to be that is where the tide was turning, that they're either... you had people being shy and talking to pollsters, or else the polling strategies or the polling techniques that are used just really aren't good enough in modern to capture the modern political world. The polls were wrong. If we bear in mind about Donald Trump's victory, you know, in 2016, and you know, we look in, you know, in Ireland, we look, the Irish Times polls that we do would have 1,000 people over a population of, you know, 4 million or maybe 3 million voters. I've seen polls in the United States being of 1,000 and odd people across the entire country. We had polls based on internet polls based on mobiles. And the question then was, how real were they? How many people answer cold calls to mobile phones anymore in terms of who they are? And given the amount of money that's spent in this country on polling, given that the polls have got it wrong, it would appear to have got it wrong again, you would question their value into the future. Although the polling companies no doubt will tell you, we were right at the time and the people changed their mind. You know, I'm sure that would be their argument. But I think there is an issue going forward in relation to polling data and the reliance on polling data and the reliance on punditry based on that polling data.
That's very interesting. I mean, just before we came on to record this, I was listening to the 538 podcast, Nate Silver, who's probably kind of the best known polling guru in the United States in terms of amassing all this data and taking consequences for it. And he, of course, was defending his position. But I think there is a real question, isn't there, because of the underestimation of Republican votes in the last two presidential elections. Probably many of these pollsters have been adjusting the way in which they do this, and they may have been adjusting too far in the other direction. So it's that's going to be an interesting question for the future, isn't it? Because there's so much reliance is placed on these polls, so much trust is placed on them, and it looks as if it's misplaced.
The conspiracy theory on the part of the Democrats and certain Democratic strategists who have turned out to be correct, bear in mind in the last few hours, their argument was, now again, as we say in relation to these conspiracy theories, without any evidence being put forward, but their contention was that this was a deliberate strategy by some Republicans that they were putting forward as the Democrats would claim bogus polls or, you know, dodgy polls, with the view to creating a narrative in the media, and that would lead to people saying, well, what's the point of going out and voting anyway if they if it's all predetermined that there's going to be a red wave or Republican landslide to any event. And as it transpired, that did not happen, and that there were sufficient people who were exercised by the issues of abortion that were able to overlook the issues of the economy, which is a big issue. And, you know, the cost of living is very expensive here, and you know, the cost of fuel, the cost of filling your car is very expensive. Although from an Irish perspective, it would be much cheaper. But from an American perspective, prices have increased quite significantly. And yet the public seem to have overlooked that to vote and overlook Joe Biden's unpopularity to essentially give the Democrats still, let's call it at this point, a fighting chance to holding their majority in the Senate. And it looks like it has limited the Republican majority in the House of Representatives, if it transpires to be that case, to a very slim majority.
Another element of this, which we won't know about for a while, because it takes a while to get final figures on it for obvious reasons, is that in a very highly polarized political system like you have now in the United States, turnout is crucial. And there's generally an assumption in the midterms that turnout is lower, that people are less motivated, that very often the people whose president is in the White House kind of are less motivated to go to the polls, and the people who are angry at the president of the White House are more motivated. But all those kinds of traditional understandings of turnout, I think, have been turned upside down in the era of Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think, well, in the last, apart from the issue of abortion, which obviously the Democrats spent a lot of money trying to galvanize a base to be angry, although I'm sure a lot of people were angry anyway, but they tried to, you know, exacerbate that, make that position stronger, based around abortion, that people have also, I think, the last few weeks, the Democrats have, and particularly the president, has based their campaign around the future of democracy. And they argued that there were election deniers on the ballot. There were 300 of them around the country, people who maintained that Joe Biden was not the legitimate president, that Donald Trump was really should be president. And I think the subliminal argument, or maybe the more explicit argument, was don't worry about this election in 2022, but if these guys win, what are they going to do in 2024? That if there's a close election in 2024, will you have some people who have a role of certifying elections, refusing to certify elections, not because the person who won didn't win, but just because he didn't like the result that they had emerged from the voters? And I think that would appear to have had some resonance with the public as well today. So you had the issue of abortion, you had the issue of the future of democracy, competing essentially with the Republican narrative, which was about the economy and about crime. Crime was a big issue, and the Republicans in many cases sought to paint their Democrat opponents as being soft on crime. Hence, we saw, for example, in Pennsylvania, the accusations that John Fetterman, the candidate who won the seat, that they went back to his days on the parole board. And, you know, parole is a process and it goes to, they seem to be arguing that he was willy-nilly just allowing murderers and killers and violent criminals just out of jail because for ideological reasons. And that was also resonating on the doorsteps as well in Pennsylvania. I was there two, three weeks ago, and canvassers were saying that was, people were saying this Fetterman guy wants to let all the criminals out of jail, you know, that. So it was resonating. But I think that the issue of democracy, the issue of abortion, has, if we pardon the pun, trumped the arguments over the economy and crime by the Republicans.
Yeah, and I think you can see that in places like Wisconsin, for example, where the Democratic governor held on and where actually there's still quite a tight contest going on, although the Republicans are likely to hold on to the Senate seat there. So I think both abortion and these kind of democratic issues are at play in Wisconsin.
You mentioned there, Hugh, and we probably should allude to it at this point. There were three governor races in the Midwest, essentially, Michigan being and Wisconsin being two of them. And the fear there was, I think, from very high-level Democratic strategists were that if they lost out, they have Republican legislatures and Democratic governors, that if they lost out today and you had a Republican governor, the legislature would pass very significant voting restrictions over the next 12 months leading up to the elections in 2024. You could have, for example, the suggestions whereby that for mail-in ballots, they would have to be notarized. You have to go to a public notary to prove who you were before you did that. And obviously that would be seen to be suppressing the vote. But the re-election of these Democratic governors in those Midwest states means that any such restrictions being proposed by the legislature could be vetoed. So it's a very important issue. Those governor elections this evening will be very, very important for the Democratic a political establishment as we move into 2024.
And then turning to the House of Representatives, if the Republican anticipation was of a relatively comfortable majority, let's say, you know, 25, 30 seats, something of that sort, and if it turns out to be, as I think, you know, early days again, we're not sure, but, you know, if we think it might be just very low double digits, 10 to 15 or something, that puts the Republican leadership, as you say, at the mercy of, I think, what we can fairly and objectively and empirically call the crazy wing of the Republican Party, the Christian nationalists, the Marjorie Taylor Greens of this world, which could be really chaotic and also project a very negative image of the Republicans to the American electorate over the next 2 years.
Plus, they would more than likely spend their time on the phone to Donald Trump and asking Trump what he wanted them to do for every particular issue that came along. It would produce, and as we have seen, Trump has not proven to be the most adroit political strategist over the last number of years. You know, Trump won in 2016. That's absolutely true. He lost the House in 2018. He lost election in 2020. And his actions in 2020, particularly in Georgia, where he basically discouraged his own supporters from voting in the runoff election, lost the Republicans the majority in the Senate. So does Trump, if this wing, this more extreme, the MAGA wing of the House of Representatives, in cahoots with Trump, would cause quite significant difficulties for the Republican leadership into the future, and particularly the putative Speaker Kevin McCarthy, as to where that goes and what his proposals and plans are. So it will make life very, very difficult for Kevin McCarthy. In fact, it could make life so difficult that McCarthy's ambition of being Speaker in itself would depend on the MAGA wing of the Republican Party voting for him, given that the numbers are so tight. If the numbers, before the abortion before the abortion issue of the Supreme Court last June, Republicans were talking about a majority of 60 seats, so which would have given him McCarthy the room to basically tell the extreme wing to get lost if he were causing him problems. Now he needs them. So it's a very delicate balance we're going to see on the Republican side if the numbers are as tight ultimately as we believe they may be, with all the health warnings and provisos that cancer is still going on.
So there are two parts of the United States that were definitely brighter spots for the Republicans last night. They picked up some seats in New York State, and they did extremely well in Florida. And I think the second one of those is particularly significant because alongside those gains in the House in Florida, the governor, Ron DeSantis, romped home with a very, very comfortable majority. Florida now seems to be established as a red state, whereas it was generally seen as a battleground state for the past several decades. And that, I think, will in many quarters, particularly in the Republican Party, be seen as Ron DeSantis' achievement. Things are shaping up more and more as a DeSantis versus Trump contest to run for president for the Republicans. And this was a good night for DeSantis and a bad night for Trump, it seems to me.
Yeah, the big winner out of these midterm elections, apart from Joe Biden, who obviously will be quite happy where they was, Ron DeSantis. If 4 years ago, when Ron DeSantis became governor, he won by about 30,000 votes. He won today by an excess of 1.6 million. He crushed his opponent. In addition, the constituency maps in Florida have been redrawn and to the advantage of the Republicans, pushed through by DeSantis. And as part of that, on foot of that redistricting, as they call it here, the Republicans won four additional seats. So if it comes down to a very, very tight majority in the House of Representatives, it will be based around what DeSantis did. His own win, he managed to break down the barriers in big, previously impenetrable Democratic strongholds around Miami. He built inroads into the Hispanic vote, larger inroads into the Hispanic vote. And he will be seen as basically his argument if he runs or wants to run in 2024, that he has the ability to put together a coalition that can win. Trump obviously recognises this. Trump essentially announced yesterday that he's going to make his formal throwing his hat into the ring for 2024 next Tuesday in Mar-a-Lago. And he basically warned DeSantis today not to basically step on his parade and to stay out of the presidential race. And he warned that he had information that would be very unflattering to DeSantis, which he would disseminate if DeSantis decides to run. So, and then obviously we had the rite of passage of Trump receiving a nickname from Trump last weekend, where he was talking about Ron DeSanctimonious. So there's obviously there's tensions there. I think Trump wants to announce his candidacy for the presidency next week and then give himself 4 or 5 months to run up a really big score among the Republican base to frighten off everybody else. DeSantis could, as you say, rein in that parade. And I think he's trying to warn him off from that. But DeSantis winning in Florida in such a manner is sending a message to the Republican establishment around the United States that he is the coming man and he can put together a coalition that could win across the country. And it remains to be seen where that goes. But I would watch that space, that DeSantis-Trump rivalry over the coming months.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, listening to voices from the Republican establishment, they definitely want DeSantis to win. I mean, it goes beyond ideology. They think that he can win for them and they don't believe Trump can win for him. And you know, that argument is bolstered by certainly some Trump-nominated candidates were victorious last night, but many weren't, particularly some of the more outre Trumpist ones, you know, like the gubernatorial candidate Kerry Lake or Doug Mastriano in Pennsylvania. So, you know, this is another, as you said earlier, this is another example of the increasing amount of evidence that Trump may be still the darling of the Republican Party, but he can't win elections for them.
Yeah, Trump did an interview today where he said that if his proteges, let's call them, won, all the credit would be for him, but if they lost, it would be their own fault. And he wasn't taking any responsibility for it. The interesting part, I think, we've seen, okay, he supported J.D. Vance in Ohio. Vance beat Tim Ryan after a very tough fight. Interesting about Ohio, Tim Ryan was so strong that it forced the Republican establishment to invest $30 million behind Vance to get him over the line. That's $30 million that in other circumstances would have went to Colorado, would have went to Arizona, where there were better chances of unseating serving Democrats. Vance won, obviously, he was a Trump supported candidate. Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania lost. The Republican establishment never wanted Oz. They wanted a hedge fund manager. It was would have been far more establishment a person to run, but lost out because Trump supported Oz. Obviously, there's the issue of the Herschel Walker situation in Georgia. The Republican establishment did not want Walker to win, but Walker was backed by Trump. And the key issue will be Arizona. Now, as we are recording this, all of the Republican candidates in Arizona, from governor down, all of the, and Arizona is a case in point of its own because virtually all of the people are election deniers on the top of the ticket. They're all running behind their Democrat opponents at this point. Particularly, you know, Trump has particularly embraced Carrie Lake, the lady who's running for governor, and she has embraced Trumpism. She described herself as Trump in a dress. And there were speculation that if Trump won and she won, that she could be a vice presidential, Trump's vice presidential candidate in 2 years' time. If she loses, it shows that that no matter how you embrace Trump, it may not necessarily be a ticket to victory. So that's, as I say, the message to the Republican establishment from these elections, if Arizona goes the way the trends are going, and it may or may not at this point, is that Trump doesn't guarantee you that you're going to win.
Although if we've learned anything over the last few years, it's that the Republican establishment doesn't control the Republican Party.
That is correct. And, you know, we've seen that in the UK as well, that the grassroots can dictate to the leadership. And I don't think Trump will go down without a fight. So we could have some fireworks in the weeks ahead, depending on how. And the other interesting part is, as of yesterday, only yesterday and this morning, even before the election was started, there was finger pointing going on within the Democratic establishment over who was responsible for this landslide defeat that they were expecting to face. Tonight, you're already beginning to see on American television, the finger pointing within the Republican establishment as to what went wrong. Why did they not win? They had everything. All the wins were in their favour. And why did they not? Was it the candidates? Was it the election strategy? What went wrong? Because I don't think they will ever have, the stars were aligning for them to have a complete landslide across the board. And it just hasn't materialised. It's not, you know, people were saying, is it going to be a red wave? Is it going to be a red ripple? There doesn't seem to be red anything. It doesn't seem, that just doesn't have. Seem to have happened in any way. And tonight was not the night that they were anticipating. And, you know, there were scenes on American television earlier on of what should have been parties and ballrooms and whatever in hotel ballrooms. They were empty. You know, there was nothing there. There was nobody. There was no celebrations.
Yeah, it's reminiscent of the big Clinton victory party in New York in 2016. A last question, actually, speaking of the Democratic Party. If the red wave had happened last night, and people would undoubtedly have associated with the current unpopularity of Joe Biden, I think it probably would have been a nail in the coffin of Joe Biden running for president for a second time in 2024. But now that's all changed as well, hasn't it? And Biden looks better positioned.
It certainly makes him look in a better position. And the other part would be is that we don't know whether the economy be better in 2024. We hope it will be in terms of it. So it will come down, I suspect, to Biden has said he intends to run. It will depend on his health, I would suspect, at the time, 2 years down the way. In many ways, it may also, I think, depend on is Trump going to run? Because I think Biden believes that he is the only candidate on the Democratic side who could defeat Trump. If Trump doesn't get the nomination, if Trump doesn't run or Trump is ejected from the Republican party or the Republican race in 2024, maybe that imperative may not be there. It depends. Biden is certainly a stronger position tonight than he was before polling opened this morning. As he got off his helicopter in the White House after coming back from his final rally on Monday night, he was asked what he thought. He said, "I'm optimistic." And then he added the rider, "but I'm always optimistic," which sounded like a little bit of hedging your bets. And he was then asked, he said, what would happen if Republicans won? And he said it would be very difficult or more difficult. Now, we have to bear in mind, and, you know, it is a good night for Democrats. They've held the tide back as much as they can. Even a Republican victory in the House of 3, 4, 5 seats, whatever it may be, will have posed challenges. There's going to be a lot of investigations. The Republicans will still control the committees that will investigate. You'll hear an awful lot about Hunter Biden and his business dealings and his laptop and all the rest of it. You're going to hear a lot about, you know, the withdrawal from the chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan. We're going to hear a lot about COVID and how the origins of COVID and the role of Anthony Fauci, who's become a hate figure for some on the right in relation to lockdowns. You'll see a lot of that. And perhaps more importantly, from an international point of view, the issue of Ukraine and the funding of the Ukrainian government by the Biden administration to the tune of billions and billions of dollars of arms and financial support. The Republicans, although they are divided among themselves, seem to be taking a more sceptical view of that and certainly talking about not offering Biden a blank check to give to Ukraine. So there could be a lot of issues there. What would happen, for example, if the Republicans say we will agree to fund Ukraine, but in return for a cut in funding for Social Security or Medicare in the United States? Very interesting dilemmas for the president, one way or the other. So a good night for him, but there's a lot of challenges still ahead.
Indeed there is, and we'll continue to cover it. Martin, thanks very much for joining us, and make sure you get some sleep now. And that's it for today. Thanks indeed very much to Martin for staying up so late, and to our producer Suzanne Brennan for getting up so early, and also to our engineer JJ Vernon. We'll be back very soon with the next podcast from the Inside Politics team. But until then, goodbye, and thanks very much for listening. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taking to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.